assume the full responsibility for the departure of one of their parents. So in the case of your daughter, yeah, that might apply. Here I'm thinking of the symptoms of thanatophobia. That's a brooding and neurotic depression over the notion of people dying. Chris's stare grew intense. In children, the psychiatrist continued, you find it accompanied by guilt formation that's related to family stress, very often the fear of the loss of a parent. It produces rage and intense frustration. In addition, the guilt in this type of hysteria needn't be known to the conscious mind. It could even be the guilt that we call free-floating, which means it relates to nothing in particular. So this fear of death thing, the thanatophobia, yeah, right, what you said. Is it something that's inherited? Looking slightly aside to avoid betraying his curiosity about the question, the psychiatrist said, No, I don't think so. Chris lowered her head and shook it. I just don't get it, she said. I'm confused. She looked up, gentle furrows lightly lining her brow. I mean, where does this new personality come in? As I said, I don't know. The psychiatrist seemed to be choosing his words as carefully as flat round stones to skim over a pond. It's fairly extraordinary for a child of her age to be able to pull together and organize the components of a new personality. And certain, well, there are some other things that are puzzling. Her performance with the Ouija board, for example, would indicate extreme suggestibility. Yet apparently, I never really hypnotized her. He shrugged. Maybe she resisted. But the really striking thing, he noted, is the new personality's apparent precocity. It isn't a 12-year-old at all. It's much older. And then there's the language she was speaking. His voice trailed off as he stared into the fireplace pensively. There's a similar state, of course, but we don't know very much about it. Oh? What's that? The psychiatrist turned to her. Well, it's a form of somnambulism where the subject suddenly manifests knowledge or skills that he's never learned, and where the intention of the second personality is to... He broke off. Well, it's terribly complicated, he resumed, and I've oversimplified outrageously. He had also not completed his statement, for fear of unduly upsetting Chris. The intention of the second personality, he would have said, was the destruction of the first. And so, what's the bottom line? A bit squiggly, ma'am. She needs an intensive examination by a team of specialists, 2 or 3 weeks of really concentrated study in a clinical atmosphere, someplace, like the Barringer Clinic in Dayton. Chris turned away, looking down. That's a problem? The psychiatrist asked her. Chris shook her head and said softly and morosely, No, I just lost hope. That's all. I didn't get you. Long story. The psychiatrist telephoned the Barringer Clinic. They agreed to take Reagan the following day. The doctors left. Chris swallowed the ache of remembrance of Dennings, thought again about death and the worm and the void and the unspeakable loneliness, the stillness and the silence and the darkness that awaited beneath the sod. No movement, no breathing, nothing. It's too much. It's too much. Chris lowered her head and briefly wept, and then put it away. Packing for the trip, Chris was standing in her bedroom, selecting a camouflaging wig to wear in Dayton, when Carl appeared at the open door. There was someone to see her, he told her. Who, Carl? Detective. Detective? He wants to see me?
Yes, madam.
Carl entered and handed Chris a business card.
William F. Kinderman, it announced. Lieutenant of Detectives.
The words were printed in an ornate, raised Tudor typeface that might have been selected by a dealer in antiques. Tucked in a corner, like a poor relation, were the smaller words, Homicide Division. Chris looked up at Carl with a tight-eyed suspicion.
Carl, has he got something with him that might be a script? You know, a big manila envelope or something?
There was no one in the world, Chris had come to discover, who didn't have a novel or a script or a notion for one or both tucked away in a drawer or a mental sock. She seemed to attract them as strongly as priests attracted derelicts and drunks.
Carl shook his head. No, madam.
Detective. Was it something to do with Burke? Chris found him sagging in the entry hall, the brim of his limp and crumpled hat clutched with short, fat fingers whose nails had the shine of a recent manicure. Plumpish, in his early 60s, he had jowly cheeks that gleamed of soap. He wore rumpled trousers, cuffed and baggy, beneath an oversized gray tweed overcoat that hung long and loose and old-fashioned. As Chris approached him, the detective told her, in a hoarsely emphysematous, whispery voice,
I'd know that face in any lineup, Miss McNeil.
Am I in one? Chris asked.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, no, 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 no. No, of course not. No, it's strictly routine, he assured her.
Look, you're busy then tomorrow.
Yes, I'll come again tomorrow.
He was turning away as if to leave when Chris said anxiously, What is it? Is it Burke? Burke Dennings? The detective's loose and careless ease had somehow tightened the springs of her tension. He turned and came back to her, dolefully staring with moist brown eyes that drooped at the corners and seemed perpetually staring at times gone by.
Oh, what a terrible shame, he said.
A shame.
Was he killed?
Chris asked him bluntly. I mean, you're a homicide cop. Is that why you're here? Burke was killed?
No. As I told you, it's routine. Please, the detective repeated. You know, a man so important, we just couldn't pass it. We couldn't, he repeated with a helpless look and a shrug. At least one or two questions. Did he fall? Was he pushed?
As he asked, he was listing from side to side with his head and an uplifted hand, palm outward. Then he shrugged and whispered huskily,
Who knows?
Was he robbed?
No, not robbed, Miss McNeil. Never robbed. But then who needs a motive in times like these?
The detective's hands were constantly in motion, like flabby gloves informed by the fingers of a bored puppeteer.
Why, today, for a murderer, a motive is an encumbrance, maybe even a deterrent. He shook his head. These drugs, he bemoaned. All these drugs.
He tapped at his chest with the tips of his fingers.
Believe me, I'm a father, and when I see what's going on, it breaks my heart.
It does.
You've got children?
Yes, one.
Son or daughter?
A daughter.
Oh, God bless her.
Look, come on into the study, Chris told him as she turned to lead the way, intensely anxious to hear what it was he had to say about Dennings.
Oh, Miss McNeil, could I trouble you for something?
Chris stopped and turned to face him with the dim and weary expectation that he wanted her autograph for his children. It was never for themselves. It was always for their children.
Yes, sure, she said amiably, in an effort to mask her impatience.
The detective gestured with a trace of a grimace.
My stomach, he said.
Do you keep maybe any calcium water? If it's trouble, never mind.
No.
No trouble at all, Chris answered with a faint, tight smile. Grab a chair in the study. Chris pointed, then turned and headed for the kitchen. I think there's a bottle in the fridge, she said.
Oh, come to the kitchen, the detective said, following with a gait that bordered on a waddle. Yes, I hate to be a bother.
It's no bother. No, really, you're busy. I'll come. You've got children? The detective asked as they walked. Oh, no, that's right, he immediately corrected himself. Yes, yes, a daughter, you told me. That's right, just the one. And how old is she?
She just turned 12, said Chris.
Ah, then you don't have to worry.
No, no, not yet.
Later on, though, watch out. He was shaking his head. When you see all the sickness day in and day out, unbelievable, incredible, insane. You know, I looked at my wife just a couple of days ago, or maybe weeks, I forget. I said, Mary, the world, the entire world, he had lifted his hands in a global gesture, is having a massive, nervous breakdown. They had entered the kitchen where Carl was cleaning and polishing the interior of an oven. He neither turned nor acknowledged their presence.
This is really so embarrassing, the detective wheezed as Chris opened a refrigerator door.
And yet his gaze was on Carl, brushing swiftly and questioningly over the back of the manservant's head, like a small dark bird skimming low above a lake.
I meet a famous motion picture star, he continued, and I ask for some Kelso water. It's a joke.
Chris had found the bottle and was looking for an opener. She said, ice? Oh, no, no, plain. Plain is fine. Chris opened the bottle, found a glass, and poured bubbly Kelso water into it.
Ah, you know that film you made called Angel? The detective mentioned with a faint, fond look of reminiscence. I saw that film 6 times, he said. If you were looking for the murderer, arrest the director.
Oh, no, 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 it was excellent. Really, really, I loved it. Just one little... Come on, we can sit over here, Chris interrupted him. She was pointing to the windowed breakfast nook. It had a waxed pine table and seat cushions covered in a flower pattern.
Yes, of course, the detective replied.
They sat down, and Chris handed him the Kelso water.
Oh, yes, thank you, he said.
Don't mention it. Now, you were saying?
Oh, well, the film. It was lovely, really. So touching. But maybe just one little thing, the detective ventured. One tiny, almost minuscule flaw.
Please believe me, in such matters, I'm only a layman, okay? I'm just audience, what do I know?
However, it seemed to me the musical score was getting in the way of certain scenes. It was too intrusive.
Chris tried not to fidget with impatience as the detective went on earnestly, caught up in the rising ardor of his argument.
It kept reminding me that this was a movie, you know? Like so many of these fancy camera angles, so distracting.
Incidentally, the score. The composer, did he steal it perhaps from Mendelssohn? Chris had started drumming her fingertips lightly on the table, but now abruptly she stopped. What kind of detective was this, she wondered, and why was he constantly glancing to Carl?
We don't call that stealing, we call it an homage, said Chris, smiling faintly.
But I'm glad you liked the picture.
Better drink that, she added with a nod at the glass of Kelso water.
Tends to get flat.
Oh, yes, of course. I'm so garrulous. Forgive me.
Lifting the glass as if in a toast, the portly detective drained its contents, his little finger arched up in the air demurely.
Ah, good, that's good, he exhaled.
As he set down the glass, his glance fell fondly on Reagan's sculpture of the bird. It was now the centerpiece of the table, its long beak floating mockingly above the salt and pepper shakers.
It's so quaint, he said, smiling. So cute.
He looked up at Chris. And the artist?
My daughter. Very nice.
Look, I hate to be...
Yes, yes, I know, you're very busy.
Listen. One or two questions and we're done, that's all. In fact, only one question, that's all, and then I'll be going. He was glancing at his wristwatch as if he were anxious to get away to some important appointment. Since poor Mr. Dennings, he began, had completed his filming in this area, We wondered if he might have been visiting someone on the night of the accident. Now, other than yourself, of course, did he have any friends in this area?
Oh, he was here that night, Chris told him.
Oh, really?
The detective's eyebrows sickled upward. Near the time of the accident, he asked.
Well, when did it happen?
At 7:05 p.m.
Yes, I think so.
Well, that settles it then.
The detective nodded, twisting in his chair as if preparatory to rising.
He was drunk, he was leaving, he fell down the steps.
Huh. Yep, that settles it, definitely.
Listen, though, just for the sake of the record, can you tell me approximately what time he left the house?
With a tilt of her head to the side, Chris appraised him with mild wonder. He was pawing at truth like a weary bachelor, pinching vegetables and fruit at a market.
I don't know, she replied. I didn't see him.
The detective looked puzzled.
I don't understand.
Well, he came and left while I was out. I was over at a doctor's office in Roslyn.
The detective nodded. Ah, I see. Yes, of course. But then
how did you know he was here?
Oh, well, Sharon's at... Sharon? He interrupted.
Yeah, Sharon Spencer. She's my secretary.
Oh, she was here when Burke dropped by. He came to see her?
No, he came to see me.
Ah, yes. Go on, please. Forgive me for interrupting.
My daughter was sick, and Sharon left him here while she went to pick up some prescriptions, and by the time I got home, Burke was gone.
And what time was that?
You remember?
Chris shrugged and puckered her lips.
Oh, maybe 7:15 or so, 7:30.
And what time had you left the house?
6:15-ish.
And what time had Miss Spencer left?
I don't know.
Between the time Miss Spencer left and the time you returned, who was here in the house with Mr. Dennings besides your daughter?
Well, no one.
No one? He left alone a sick child?
Chris nodded, her expression blank.
No servants?
No. Willie and Carl. Who were Willie and Carl? Chris abruptly felt the earth shifting under her feet as the nuzzling interview, she realized, was suddenly a steely interrogation.
Well, Carl's right there.
Chris motioned with her head, her glance fixed dully on the manservant's back as he continued to clean and polish the oven. And Willie's his wife, Chris said. They're my housekeepers.
Polishing. Why? The oven had been thoroughly cleaned and polished the night before.
They'd taken the afternoon off, Chris continued, and when I got home, they weren't back yet. But when Willie...
Chris paused, her eyes still fixed on Carl's back.
Willie what? The detective prodded.
Chris turned to him and shrugged. Oh, well, nothing, she said. She reached for a cigarette.
Kinderman lit it.
So then, only your daughter would know, he asked, when Burke Dennings left the house?
It was really an accident.
Oh, of course. It's routine, Miss McNeil. Absolutely. Your friend Dennings wasn't robbed, and so what would be the motive?
Well, Burke could tick people off, Chris said somberly.
Maybe someone at the top of the steps just hauled off and whacked him.
It's got a name, this kind of bird. I can't think of it. Something.
The detective was fingering Reagan's sculpture. Noticing Chris's steady stare, he took away his hand, looking vaguely embarrassed. Oh, forgive me, you're busy. Well, a minute and we're done. Now your daughter, she would know when Mr. Dennings left?
No, she wouldn't. She was heavily sedated.
Ah, a shame. Such a shame.
The detective's eyelids drooped with concern.
It's serious, he asked.
Yes.
I'm afraid it is.
May I ask? He had raised his hand in a delicate gesture.
We still don't know. Watch out for drafts, the detective said solemnly. A draft in the winter, when a house is hot as a magic carpet for bacteria, my mother used to say that. Maybe it's folk myth. Maybe. I don't know. But plainly speaking, to me a myth is like a menu in a fancy French restaurant. It's glamorous, complicated camouflage for a fact you wouldn't otherwise swallow, like maybe the lima beans they're constantly giving you whenever you go out and order hamburger steak. Chris felt herself loosening up. The odd, homey digression had relaxed her. The fuddled-looking, harmless St. Bernard dog had returned. "That's hers, Miss McNeil, your daughter's bedroom?" The detective was pointing up at the ceiling. "The one with that big bay window looking out on those steps?" Chris nodded. "Yeah, that's Reagan's." "Keep the window closed and she'll get better." Tense the moment before, Chris now had to struggle to keep from laughing. "Yes, I will," she said. "In fact, it's always closed and shuttered." "Yes, an ounce of prevention," the detective quoted sententiously. He was dipping a pudgy hand into the inside pocket of his coat when his gaze fell on Chris's fingertips, again lightly drumming on the table. "Ah, yes, you're busy. Well, we're finished. Just a note for the record. Routine. That's it, and we're all done." From the pocket of his coat, he'd extracted a crumpled mimeograph program of a high school production of Cyrano de Bergerac, and now he was groping in an outer pocket, retrieving a short yellow stub of a number 2 pencil, whose point had the look of having been sharpened with either a knife or the blade of a pair of scissors. Then, pressing the play program flat on the table and tamping out the wrinkles, he held the pencil stub over it and wheezed, "Just a name or two, that's all, nothing more. Now, that's Spencer with a C?" "Yes, a C." "A C," the detective repeated, writing the name in a margin of the program. "And the housekeepers, Joseph and Willie?" "No, it's Carl and Willie Engstrom." Carl, yes, right, Carl Engstrom." He scribbled the names in a dark, thick script. "Now the times I remember," he breathed out huskily, while rotating the program in search of white space. "Oh, no, wait, I forgot. Yes, the housekeepers. Now, you said they got home at what time?" "I didn't say." "Carl, what time did you get in last night?" Chris called out to him. The Swiss turned his head, inscrutable. "I am home at exactly 9:30. "Oh, yeah, that's right, you'd forgotten your key." She turned her gaze back to the detective. "I remember I looked at the clock in the kitchen when I heard him ring the doorbell." "You saw a good film?" the detective asked Carl. "I never go by reviews," he said to Chris in a quiet aside. "It's what the people think, the audience." "Paul Schofield in Lear," Carl informed the detective. "Ah, I saw that. It was excellent." "I see it at Gemini Theater," Carl continued. "The 6 o'clock showing. Then immediately after, I take bus from in front of the theater, and please, that's not necessary." The detective protested as he held up a hand, palm outward. No, please. "I don't mind, if you insist. I get off at Wisconsin Avenue and M Street, 9:20, I think, and then I walk to house." "Look, you didn't have to tell me," the detective told him. "But anyway, thank you, it was very considerate. By the way, you liked the film?" "It was good." Yes, I thought so too. Exceptional." "Well now," he turned back to Chris and to scribbling on the program. "I've wasted your time, but I have a job. That's the sad yin and yang of it, the whole deal." "Oh well, a moment and we're finished," he said reassuringly. Then, tragic, he added, as he jotted down fragments and margins. "Such a talent, Burke Dennings. And a man who knew people, I'm sure, how to handle them, with so many who could make him look good or make him look bad, like the cameraman, the sound man, the composer, not to mention, forgive me, the actors. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me nowadays a director of importance has to be almost a psychologist with the cast. Am I wrong?" No, you're not. Because we're all insecure." "Even you?"
mostly me. But Burke was good at that, keeping up your morale. Chris shrugged diffidently. Then, of course, he had one sweetheart of a temper. The detective repositioned the program. Ah, well, maybe so with the big shots, people his size. Once again, he was scribbling. But the key is the little people. The people who handle the minor details that if they didn't handle right, would be major details, don't you think? Chris sighed her fingernails and shook her head. When Burke let fly, she said, he never discriminated. But it was only mean when he drank. All right, we're finished. We're done. Kinderman was dotting a final I when he abruptly remembered something. Oh, no, wait, the Engstroms. They went and they came together? No, Willie went to see a Beatles film, Chris answered, just as Carl was turning his head to reply. She got in a few minutes after I did. Huh. Well, why did I ask that, said Kinderman. Has nothing to do with anything. He folded up the program and tucked it away along with the pencil in the inside pocket of his coat. Well, that's that, he breathed out with satisfaction. When I'm back in the office, no doubt I'll remember something that maybe I should have asked. Yeah, with me, that always happens. Oh, well, whatever, he said. I could call you. He stood up and Chris got up with him. Well, I'm going out of town for a couple of weeks, she said. Oh, it can wait, the detective assured her. It can wait. He was staring at the sculpture with a smiling fondness again. Oh, so cute, so really, really cute. He'd leaned over and picked it up, and was rubbing his thumb along the sculpted bird's beak, then replaced it on the table and started to leave. Have you got a good doctor? The detective asked, as Chris accompanied him toward the front door. I mean for your daughter. Well, I've sure got enough of them, Chris said glumly. Anyway, I'm checking her into a clinic that's supposed to be graded, doing what you do, only with viruses. Let's hope they're much better at it, Miss McNeil. It's out of town, this clinic? Yes, it is. It's in Ohio. It's a good one? We'll see. Keep her out of the draft. They had reached the front door of the house. Well, I would say that it's been a pleasure, the detective said gravely, while gripping his hat by the brim with both hands. But under the circumstances, he bent his head slightly and shook it. Then looked back up. I'm so terribly sorry. Her arms folded across her chest. Chris lowered her head and said quietly, Thank you. Thank you very much. Opening the door, the detective stepped outside, put on his hat, and turned back to look at Chris. Well, good luck with your daughter, he said. Chris smiled wanly. Good luck with the world. The detective nodded with a warmth and a sadness, then turned to his right and, short of breath, slowly waddled away down the street. Chris watched as he listed toward a waiting squad car that was parked near the corner. He flung up a hand to his hat as a sudden gust of wind sprang sharply from the south and set the bottom of his long, floppy coat to flapping. Chris lowered her gaze and closed the door. When he'd entered the passenger side of the squad car, Kinderman turned and, looking back at the house, he thought he'd seen movement at Reagan's window, a quick, lithe figure moving quickly to the side and out of view. He wasn't sure. He had seen it peripherally, and so quickly, it was almost subliminal. He kept looking, and noticed that the window shutters were open. Odd. Chris had told him they were always closed. For a time, the detective continued to watch. No one appeared. With a puzzled frown, the detective looked down and shook his head, and then he opened the glove compartment of the squad car, extracted a penknife and an evidence envelope, and unclasping the smallest of the blades of the knife, he held his thumb inside the envelope and extracted from under a thumbnail microscopic fragments of green-colored clay he'd surreptitiously scraped from Reagan's sculpture. Finished, he sealed up the envelope and placed it in the inside pocket of his coat. "Okay," he told his driver, "let's go." They pulled away from the curb, and as they drove down Prospect Street, Kinderman cautioned the driver, "Take it easy," as he noticed the traffic building up ahead. Then, lowering his head, he shut his eyes, and gripping the bridge of his nose with weary fingers, he breathed out despondently, "Oh, my God, what a world! What a life!" Later that evening, while Dr. Klein was injecting Reagan with 50 milligrams of sparine to assure her tranquility on the journey to Dayton, Ohio, Kinderman stood brooding in his office with the palms of his hands pressed flat atop his desk as he pored over fragments of baffling data with no other light in the room but the narrow beam of an ancient desk lamp flaring brightly on a clutter of scattered reports. He believed that it helped him to narrow the focus of his concentration. His breathing was adenoidal and heavy in the darkness. His glance flitted here, now there, and then he took a deep breath and shut his eyes. "Mental clearance sale," he instructed himself, as he always did whenever he wished to tidy up his brain for a fresh point of view. "Absolutely everything must go." Then he opened his eyes and re-examined the pathologist's report on Dennings. Tearing of the spinal cord with fractured skull and neck, plus numerous contusions, lacerations, and abrasions. Stretching of the neck skin, ecchymosis of the neck skin, shearing of the platysma, sternomastoid, splenius, trapezius, and various smaller muscles of the neck, with fracture of the spine and of the vertebrae, and shearing of both the anterior and posterior spinous ligaments. He looked out a window at the dark of the city. The Capitol dome light glowed in signal that the Congress was working late, and once again the detective shut his eyes, recalling his conversation with the district pathologist at 11:55 p.m. on the night of Denning's death.
"It could have happened in the fall?"
"Oh, well, it's very unlikely. The sternomastoids and the trapezius muscles alone are enough to prevent it. Then you've also got the various articulations of the cervical spine to be overcome, as well as the ligaments holding the bones together."
"Speaking plainly, however, Doctor, is it possible?"
"Well, yes. The man was drunk, and these muscles were doubtless somewhat relaxed. Perhaps if the force of the initial impact was sufficiently powerful..."
"Falling maybe 30-40 feet before he hit?"
"Well, yes, that. And if immediately after impact, his head got stuck in something. In other words, if there were immediate interference with the normal rotation of the head and the body as a unit. Well,
I don't know, maybe.
As I say, just maybe, you could get this result."
"Could another human being have done it?"
"Oh, yes. But he'd have to be an exceptionally powerful man." Kinderman had checked Carl Engstrom's story regarding his whereabouts at the time of Denning's death. The show times matched, as did the schedule that night, of a DC transit bus. Moreover, the driver of the bus that Carl had claimed he had boarded near the front of the theater went off duty at Wisconsin and M Streets, where Carl had stated he'd alighted at approximately 9:20. A change of drivers had taken place, and the off-duty driver had logged the time of his arrival at the transfer point. Precisely 9:18. Yet on Kinderman's desk was a record of a felony charge against Engstrom on August 27, 1963, alleging he had stolen a quantity of narcotics over a period of months from the home of a doctor in Beverly Hills, where he and Willie were then employed. Born April 21st in Zurich, Switzerland, married to Willie Nee Braun, September 7, 1941. Daughter Elvira, born New York City, January 11th, 1943, current address unknown, defendant. The remainder of the report, the detective found baffling. The doctor, whose testimony was deemed a sine qua non for successful prosecution, abruptly and without explanation, dropped the charges. Why had he done so? And as the Engstroms had been hired by Chris McNeil only 2 months later, the doctor had given them a favorable reference. Why would he do so? Engstrom had certainly pilfered the drugs, and yet a medical examination at the time of the charge had failed to yield the slightest sign that the man was an addict or even a user. Why not? With his eyes still closed, the detective softly recited the beginning of the Lewis Carroll poem, Jabberwocky. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. It was another of Kinderman's mind-clearing tricks. And when he had finished the recitation, he opened his eyes and fixed his gaze on the Capitol Rotunda. He was trying to keep his mind a blank, although, as usual, he found the task impossible. Sighing, he glanced at the police psychologist's report on the recent desecrations at Holy Trinity Church. Statue, phallus, human excrement, Damien Karras. He had underscored in red. His breathing slightly whistling in the total silence, he reached for a scholarly work on witchcraft and turned to a page that he had marked with a paper clip. Black Mass, a form of devil worship, the ritual consisting in the main of 1. Exhortation, the sermon, to performance of evil among the community. 2. Coition with the demon, reputedly painful, the demon's penis invariably described as icy cold, and 3, a variety of desecrations that were largely sexual in nature. For example, communion hosts of unusual size were prepared, compounded of flour, feces, menstrual blood, and pus, which then were slit and used as artificial vaginas, with which the priests would ferociously copulate, while raving that they were ravishing the Virgin Mother of God, or that they were sodomizing Christ. In another instance of such practice, a statue of Christ was inserted deep in a girl's vagina, while into her anus was inserted the host, which the priest then crushed as he shouted blasphemies and sodomized the girl. Life-sized images of Christ and the Virgin Mary also played a frequent role in the ritual. The image of the Virgin, for example, usually painted to give her a dissolute, sluttish appearance, was equipped with breasts which the cultists sucked, and also a vagina into which the penis might be inserted. The statues of Christ were equipped with a phallus for fellatio by both the men and the women, and also for insertion into the vagina of the women and the anus of the men. Occasionally, rather than an image, a human figure was bound to a cross and made to function in place of the statue, and upon the discharge of his semen, it was collected in a blasphemously consecrated chalice and used in the making of the communion host, which was destined to be consecrated on an altar covered with excrement. Kinderman flipped the pages to an underlined paragraph dealing with ritualistic murder, reading it slowly while nibbling at the pad of an index finger. And when he had finished, he frowned at the page and shook his head, then lifted a brooding glance to the lamp. He flicked it off and left his office. He drove to the morgue. The young attendant at the desk was munching at a ham and cheese sandwich on rye and was brushing the crumbs from a crossword puzzle as Kinderman approached him.
"Dennings," the detective breathed out hoarsely.
The attendant nodded, hastily filled in a five-letter horizontal, then rose with his sandwich and moved down the hall. "Down this way," he said laconically. Kinderman trailed him, hat in hand, following the faint scent of caraway seed and mustard to rows of refrigerated lockers, to the dreamless cabinet used for the filing of sightless eyes. They halted at locker 32. The expressionless attendant slid it out. He bit at his sandwich, and a fragment of mayonnaise-speckled crust fell lightly to the graying shroud. Kinderman stared, and then, slowly and gently, he pulled back the sheet to expose what he'd seen, and yet could not accept. Denning's head was turned completely around and facing backward. Chapter 5. Cupped in the warm green hollow of the Georgetown University campus, Damian Karras jogged alone around an oval, cinder-covered track in khaki shorts and a cotton T-shirt, drenched with the cling of healing sweat. Up ahead on a hillock, the lime-white dome of the astronomical observatory pulsed with the beat of his stride, while behind him the medical school fell away with churned-up shards of earth and care. Since release from his duties, he came here daily, lapping the miles and chasing sleep. He had almost caught it, had almost eased the grief that clutched his heart with the grip of a deep tattoo. When he ran until he wanted to fall, exhausted, the grip grew much looser and at times disappeared. For a time.
20 laps. Yeah, better, much better. 2 more.
With powerful leg muscles blooded and stinging and rippling with a long and leonine grace, Karras thumped around a turn when he noticed someone sitting on a bench to the side where he'd laid out his towel and his sweatsuit jacket and pants. It was a portly middle-aged man in a floppy overcoat and a pulpy, crushed felt hat. He seemed to be watching him. Was he? Yes. His stare always following as Karras passed. The priest accelerated, digging at the final lap with pounding strides, and then slowing to a panting, gulping walk. As he passed the bench without a glance, both fists pressed light to his throbbing sides. The heave of his muscular chest and shoulders stretched his T-shirt, distorting the stenciled word, "Philosophers," inscribed across the front, in once black letters, now faded by repeated washings. The man in the overcoat stood up and began to approach him.
"Father, Karras?"
Kinderman called to him hoarsely. The priest turned around and tersely nodded, squinting into sunlight as he waited for the homicide detective to reach him, then beckoned him along as once again he began to move.
"Do you mind?
I'll cramp," he said pantingly.
"Oh, not at all," the detective answered,
nodding with a wincing lack of enthusiasm as he tucked his hands into the pockets of his coat. The walk from the parking lot had tired him.
Have we met?" asked the Jesuit.
"No, Father, no, we haven't. But they said that you look like a boxer, some priest at the residence hall, I forget." He was tugging at his wallet. "I'm so terrible with names."
"Uh-huh. And what's yours?"
"Lieutenant William F. Kinderman, Father." He flashed his identification. "Homicide."
"Oh, really?"
Karras scanned the badge and identification card with a shining, boyish interest. Flushed and perspiring, his face had an eager look of innocence as he turned to the detective and said,
"What's this about?"
Hey, you know something, Father? Kinderman answered with an air of sudden discovery while inspecting the Jesuit's rugged features. It's really true, you know. You do look like a boxer. Excuse me, but that scar there right over your eye? He was pointing. Just like Marlon Brando, it looks, and on the waterfront. Yes, almost exactly Marlon Brando. They gave him a scar, he was illustrating, pulling at the corner of his eye, that made his eye look a little bit closed, a little dreamy all the time, a little sad. Well, that's you, he concluded. Marlon Brando. People tell you that, Father. People tell you that you look like Paul Newman? Always. And believe me, inside this body, Mr. Newman is struggling to get out. Too crowded. Inside here is also Clark Gable. Half smiling, Karras slightly shook his head and looked away.
Ever done any boxing? The detective asked him.
Oh, a little. Where? College, here in town? No, in New York.
I thought so. Golden Gloves, am I right?
You just made captain, Karras told him with a sidelong smile. Now then, what can I do for you, Lieutenant?
Walk slower. The detective pointed to his throat. Emphysema.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, sure.
Do you smoke, Father?
Yes, I do.
You shouldn't.
Listen, what's this about? Could we get to the point, please, Lieutenant?
Yes, of course.
Okay, I've been digressing, I know. Incidentally, you're busy. I'm not interrupting.
Karras turned a sidelong look to Kinderman again with a smile of bemusement in his eyes.
Interrupting what?
Well, mental prayer, perhaps.
I think you're going to make captain soon, you know that.
Father, pardon me, I miss something.
Karras shook his head.
I doubt that you ever miss a thing.
What's your meaning, Father? What?
Kinderman had halted them and mounted a massive effort at looking befuddled. But seeing the Jesuit's crinkling eyes, he lowered his head and ruefully chuckled.
Ah, well, of course. A psychiatrist. Who am I kidding? Look, it's habit with me, Father. Schmaltz. That's the Kinderman method. Well, I'll stop and I'll tell you straight what it's all about.
The desecration, said Karras.
So I wasted my schmaltz. Sorry.
Never mind, Father, that I deserve. Yes, the things in the church, he confirmed.
That's correct.
Only maybe something more than that, Father.
You mean murder?
Yes, kick me again, Father Karras. I enjoy it.
Karras shrugged.
Oh, well, homicide division.
Never mind, Marlon Brando. People tell you for a priest you're a little bit smart-ass.
Mea culpa, Karras murmured. Though he was smiling, he felt a regret that perhaps he diminished the detective's self-esteem. He hadn't meant to. And now he felt glad of a chance to seem perplexed.
What's the connection, he said, taking care that he wrinkled his brow.
I don't get it.
Kinderman moved his face in closer to the priest's.
Listen, Father, could we keep this between us? Confidential, like a matter of confession, so to speak?
Yeah, sure, of course, Karras answered. What is it?
You know that director who was doing the film here, Father, Burke Dennings?
Yeah, I've seen him around.
You've seen him, the detective said, nodding. And you're also familiar with how he died?
Karras shrugged. Well, the papers.
That's just a part of it.
Oh?
Yes. Part.
Only part. Listen, what do you,
know about witchcraft, Father?
Karras grimaced in puzzlement.
What? Listen, patience, I'm leading up to something.
I hope so.
Now then, witchcraft. With this subject you're familiar? From the witching end, Father, not the hunting.
Karras smiled.
Yeah, I once did a paper on it. From the psychiatric end.
Oh, now really? Oh, that's wonderful. Great.
That's a bonus, Father Brando. Really, you could help me a lot more than I thought. Now then, listen.
He reached up and gripped the Jesuit's arm as they rounded a turn and approached the bench.
All right. Me, I'm a layman and not very well educated.
I mean formally, Father. But I read.
Look, I know what they say about self-made men, that they're horrible examples of unskilled labor. But as for me, I'll speak plainly, I'm not at all ashamed. Not at all. Abruptly, he arrested the flow, and looking down, he shook his head. Schmaltz, he moaned. I can't seem to stop it. He looked up. Look, forgive me, you're busy. Yes, I'm praying. The Jesuit's delivery being dry and expressionless, the detective abruptly halted their walk. You're serious? He asked. And then he answered his own question. No. He faced forward again and they walked. Look, I'll come to the point. The desecration, said Kinderman. Do they remind you of anything to do with witchcraft? Yeah, maybe. Some rituals used in black mass. A plus. And now Dennings. You read how he died? Yes, in a fall down the Hitchcock steps. Well, I'll tell you, and please, confidential? Sure, of course. The detective looked suddenly pained as he realized that Karras had no intention of resting on the bench. He stopped, and the priest stopped with him. Do you mind? He asked wistfully. Mind what? Could we stop, maybe sit? Yeah, sure. They began to move back toward the bench. You wouldn't cramp, Father? No, I'm fine now. You're sure? Yes, I'm sure. Kinderman settled his aching bulk on the bench with a sigh of deep content. Ah, yes, better, much, much better. Life is not totally darkness at noon. So, canine detective, Burke Dennings, what about him? The detective stared down at his shoes. Ah, yes, Dennings, Burke Dennings, Burke Dennings. He looked up and turned his gaze to Karras, who was wiping sweat from his forehead with the corner of his towel. Burke Dennings, good father, the detective said evenly and quietly, was found at the bottom of those steps at exactly 7:05, with his head turned completely around and facing backward. Peppery shouts drifted thinly from the baseball diamond, where the varsity team was holding practice. Karras lowered the towel and held the lieutenant's steady gaze. It didn't happen in the fall? Kinderman shrugged. Sure. It's possible. But unlikely, the priest finished broodingly. And so, Father, what comes to mind in the context of witchcraft? Staring off pensively, Karras sat down on the bench next to Kinderman. Well, that's supposedly how demons broke the necks of witches. He turned to the detective. Or at least that's the myth, he said. It's a myth, Father? Oh, well, sure, the priest answered. Although people did die that way, I suppose, likely members of a coven who either defected or gave away secrets? The priest looked off. I don't know. That's just a guess. He looked back at the detective. But I do know it was a trademark of demonic assassins. Exactly, Father Karras, exactly. I remembered the connection from a murder in London. And that's now I'm talking, Father. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago only, I remembered that I read it in the papers. Yeah, I read that too, but I think it turned out to be a hoax, didn't it? Well, yes, true. But in this case, at least you can see some connection, maybe, with that and the things in the church. Maybe somebody crazy, Father. Maybe somebody with a spite against the Catholic Church. Some unconscious rebellion, perhaps. Hunched over, his hands clasped together, the priest turned his head for an appraising stare at the detective. What are you saying? A sick priest? That's your suspicion? Listen, you're the psychiatrist, Father. You tell me. Karras turned his head, looking off. Well, of course, the desecrations are clearly pathological, he ruminated. And if Dennings was murdered, well, I guess that the killer's pathological, too. And perhaps had some knowledge of witchcraft?
Pensive, Karis nodded. Yeah, maybe.
And so who fits the bill?
Also lives in the neighborhood, and also has access in the night to the church.
Karis turned and held Kinderman's stare. Then, at the crack of a bat against ball, he turned again to watch a lanky right fielder make a catch.
Sick priest, he murmured. Maybe so.
Listen, Father, I know this is hard for you. Please, I understand. But for priests on the campus here, you're the psychiatrist, right?
Karis turned to him. Well,
no. I've had a change of assignment.
Oh, really? In the middle of the year?
That's the Jesuit order.
Well, still you know who was sick at the time and who wasn't, correct? I mean, this kind of sickness. You'd know that.
No, not necessarily, Lieutenant, not at all. It would only be an accident, in fact, if I did. I'm not a psychoanalyst. All I do is counsel. Besides, I know of no one who fits the description.
Kinderman tilted up his jaw. Ah, yes, he said. Doctor's ethics. If you knew, you wouldn't tell.
No, I probably wouldn't.
Incidentally, I mentioned it only in passing. This ethic is lately considered illegal. Not to bother you with trivia, Father, but lately a psychiatrist in sunny California, no less, was put in jail for not telling the police what he knew about a patient.
Is that a threat?
Don't talk paranoid. It's nothing but a casual remark.
Karis stood up and looked down at the detective.
I could always tell the judge it was a matter of confession, he said, and then added, plainly speaking.
The detective stared at him dismally. Wanna go into business, Father? He asked him. And then he stared out at the baseball practice field.
Father? What father? You're a Jew who's trying to pass, but let me tell you, you've taken it a little bit far.
Getting up from the bench, Karis chuckled.
Yes, laugh, said the detective as he glared up at Karis moodily. Go ahead and enjoy, Father. Laugh all you want.
But then he beamed, looking impishly pleased with himself, as he looked up at Karis and said, Father, that reminds me. The entrance examination to be a policeman?
When I took it, one question on the test was, what are rabies and what would you do for them? And someone answered, rabies are Jewish priests and I would do anything that I possibly could for them.
Kinderman raised up a hand and said,
honest. Yeah, I swear to God, it happened.
Karis smiled warmly at him. Come on, Lieutenant. I'll walk you to your car. Are you parked here in the lot? The detective looked up at him, reluctant to move. Then we're finished? He asked disappointedly.
The priest put a foot on the bench, leaning over with a forearm resting on his knee.
Look, I'm really not covering up, he said. Really, if I knew of a priest like the one you're looking for, the least I would do is let you know that there was such a man without giving you his name. Then I guess I'd report it to the provincial. But I don't know of anyone who even comes close to the man that you're looking for.
Well, said Kinderman, looking down and with his hands again stuffed in the pockets of his coat. I never thought I was a priest in the first place. Nah, not really.
He looked up and gestured with his head toward the lower campus parking lot.
I'm parked over there, he said.
He stood up and they started walking, following a path to the main campus buildings.
What I really suspect, the detective continued, if I said it out loud, you would call me crazy. I don't know, he said, shaking his head. I don't know. All these clubs and these cults where they kill for no reason. It makes you start thinking things.
To keep up with the times these days, he bemoaned, it seems you have to be a little bit demented.
He turned to Karis. What's that thing on your shirt? He asked him, motioning his head toward the Jesuit's chest. What do you mean?
On the T-shirt, there's writing there. Philosophers? What's that?
Oh, yeah, I took a few courses 1 year, Karras told him, at Woodstock Seminary in Maryland. I played on the lower-class baseball team, and we were called the Philosophers.
Ah, I see. And the upper-class team?
The Ogens.
Faintly smiling, the detective lowered his gaze to the pathway.
Theologians 3, philosophers 2, he mused.
No, philosophers 3, theologians 2.
Oh, yes, of course. That's what I really meant to say.
Of course.
Strange things, the detective said broodingly. So strange.
Listen, father, he said, turning to Karras.
Listen, doctor.
Am I crazy? Or could there be, maybe, a witch coven here in the District of Columbia right now? Right now? Today?
Oh, come on, Karras scoffed.
Aha! Then there could be. Then there could be? How do you figure that?
All right now, father, I'll be the doctor, the detective declared with an air of pouncing as he poked at empty air with an index finger.
You didn't say no, but instead you were smart-ass again. That's defensive. You're afraid you'll look gullible, maybe. A superstitious priest in front of Kinderman, the rationalist, the age of reason made flesh, and now walking beside you. All right, look me in the eye now and tell me that I'm wrong. Come on, look already, look.
Yeah, see? You can't do it.
Karras turned his head to stare at the detective now, with a mounting surmise and respect.
Why, that's very astute, he told him.
That's very good.
Well, all right then, said Kidman. So I'll ask you again. Could there maybe be witch covens here in the district?
Karras turned his gaze to the pathway, looking thoughtful. Well, I really wouldn't know, he said. But there are cities in Europe where black masses are said.
You mean today?
Oh, yeah, today. In fact, the center of Satan worship in Europe is in Turin, Italy.
Weird. Why so?
That's where the burial shroud of Christ is kept.
You're talking Satan worship just like the old days, Father?
Listen, I've read about those things, incidentally, with the sects and the statues and who really knows what. Not meaning to disgust you, by the way.
But they did all those things? It's for real?
I don't know.
Well, just your opinion then, Father. It's okay. I'm not wearing a wire.
Karras shifted a wan, wry smile to the detective and then turned his gaze back to the pathway.
Well, all right then, he said.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's for real. Or, all right, let's just say I suspect so. And most of my reasoning is based on pathology.
Yeah, sure, okay. Black mass. It happens. But anyone doing those things is a very disturbed human being, and disturbed in a very special way.
There's a clinical name for that kind of disturbance, in fact. It's called Satanism, meaning people who can't have any sexual pleasure unless it's connected to a blasphemous action.
And so I think, wait, you mean suspect? Yes, I suspect that black mass was just used as the justification.
Is used.
Was and is, the detective echoed dryly. And the psychiatric name for the disorder in which the person is always having to have the last word?
Charismania, said the priest with a smile.
Thank you, Father. This was formerly a lacuna in my vast store of knowledge of the strange and exotic. In the meantime, please forgive me, but the things with the statues